Hemorrhoids can be a real pain in the butt, causing anal itching and burning and irritation. Get fast relief with all-natural, doctor-developed and tested Anacool. Buy Anacool, A-N-A-C-O-O-L, on Amazon right now and save 15% with code WABC2024.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Hello, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. It is a great pleasure to be with you today on Memorial Day weekend. We celebrate Memorial Day Monday. I want to talk a little bit about Memorial Day, if I may. We take it for granted. It's a lovely three-day weekend.
Hemorrhoids can be a real pain in the butt, causing anal itching and burning and irritation. Get fast relief with all-natural, doctor-developed and tested Anacool. Buy Anacool, A-N-A-C-O-O-L, on Amazon right now and save 15% with code WABC2024.
It's a national holiday. But it's good to think about and perhaps reflect on Memorial Day, which used to be called Decoration Day. And Memorial Day memorializes those who died in active military service for all the American wars. Brave, courageous men and women who fought to preserve our freedom and our security for the greatest country in the history of history. Memorial Day or Decoration Day began after the Civil War, after the huge losses in the Civil War, where the Union was eventually triumphant and slavery was defeated. And it's kind of an interesting story. It was originally a national day of remembrance for those brave souls. And it came, of course, to include, over time, both world wars, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq. The first formal Decoration Day was in 1868, May 30th, 1868, Civil War General James Garfield, who later, of course, became president, but Civil War General James Garfield gave a speech at the Arlington National Cemetery. 5,000 people showed up and proceeded to decorate the graves of roughly 20,000 Civil War soldiers. Think of that. May 30th, 1868. Memorializing those who gave the ultimate sacrifice at the Civil War, and of course, over time, all of the other wars. And even today, it's a national moment of remembrance at 3 p.m. local time, wherever you may be. People will be visiting cemeteries to memorialize, commemorate those who gave their lives. It's worth thinking about because in all the political wars and cultural wars that goes on today, I think a lot of people forget those who gave their lives in service to protect our country. And it's a big deal. It's a very big deal. Of course, we'll celebrate Veterans Day later in the year, November. But Memorial Day here to celebrate those who lost their lives, the brave, courageous men and women. And I would say at least my own sense is that we need to think about this in terms of celebrating the greatness of America itself. Not everybody celebrates that greatness nowadays. Standing tall. Not everybody wants to stand tall before the Pledge of Allegiance or the National Anthem. And that's too bad, because there is no other country that has the freedoms that this country has, or the accomplishments, or the achievements, or the prosperity, or the values. We'll get to July 4th in a couple of months, a little more than a month, which is, of course, another favorite holiday. We celebrate then life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness from the Declaration of Independence. But remember, Memorial Day celebrates the men and women who made the ultimate sacrifice to preserve that life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, didn't they? And perhaps we should think about that. In the midst of a terrible national tragedy in Uvalde, Texas, where we lost all those little angels, and we mourn for that. We mourn for that almost beyond mourning. I'm not going to go through the story down there. There are issues popping up. The role of the school, the role of the police. It's a horrible tragedy. I don't know enough about it. I haven't covered it firsthand. Others know much more, and I'll leave it to them. We've had a lot of tragedies in recent years, but that does not take away or remove the greatness of America, in my judgment. As bad as things can be. It's kind of easy these days, I think, to be pessimistic with economic worries dominating the landscape, with the very left-wing, far-left, woke administration that is doing very poorly and not representing this country the way we need it to be represented. But I will still argue, with all that, a more optimistic American view will prevail. An American first view will prevail. And that's why I just give this brief history about Memorial Day. We have been through difficulties, have we not? External difficulties, internal difficulties, domestic difficulties. We've been through these things before, but the greatness of the country always prevails. It always does. Why does it prevail? Because of freedom, because of our democracy, because of free speech, because people are free to pursue the kind of free market capitalism and prosperity that it brings. And they're free to pursue their ideas, and they're free to pursue their own free speech and worship of free worship of religion, and so on. But going all the way back to the Civil War, when James Garfield made that first major speech in 1868, people have fought for freedom. It's a remarkable thing. And it's something to be celebrated. It's something to think about. It's something that we must not take for granted, our freedom. You know, we must fight for our freedom. We must fight for our values. And I think, you know, mature men and women with good values should think about that here at home. Not everyone agrees on the right way to pursue freedom. I understand that. I respect people who disagree. I respect people who disagree with my own point of view as a conservative. A conservative who worked for Ronald Reagan as a young man and more recently worked for Donald Trump and have advised people in office for many, many years and represented my views in different ways as a broadcaster. But just today, we want to make America great. We want to think about making America first. We want to make America even greater, even stronger at home and stronger abroad. I think of Reagan's argument way back. If we are weak at home, we will be weak abroad. But if we are strong at home, we will be strong abroad. Strong in our economy, strong in our beliefs, strong in our values, strong in the ways that we will stand up, and perhaps best by example of our own behavior and attitudes, represent the best values of this great country, of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is the weekend of Memorial Day. Those who died in military service to protect our great country and its freedom. That's what Memorial Day is all about. Let us not forget. Please, let us not forget. I'm going to take a quick break. And on the other side, we will talk about and really devote much of this show to how we can make America greater, built on the shoulders of those people who made the ultimate sacrifice to protect our right to make America greater. I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back after this brief message.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show on 77 WABC.
Welcome back, folks. It's Larry Kudlow. By the way, you can live stream us on the internet, LarryKudlowShow.com, throughout the country and around the world and throughout the solar system. Everybody can hear it. And join us during the week, please. Fox Business. The name of the show is Kudlow, 4 to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. You can join us there. If you can't get on TV, just find your favorite 9-year-old who will teach you how to DVR the show. You won't miss a single thing. Thinking about Memorial Day and thinking about the future of this country. By the way, just as an aside, I mean, you can celebrate Memorial Day. I'm not going to mince words, but really, Memorial Day is a remembrance day. It's a day honoring people. Not so much a celebration as it is memorializing, remembrance, honoring, Decoration Day, Memorial Day. Think about that. Think about all that. Anyway, we were covering this during the week on the Fox Business show, and the Congressional Budget Office came out with its, I guess, mid-year review and looked at the longer-term outlook for the U.S. economy and budgets and deficits and revenues and taxes and all that stuff. We're going to talk to former OMB budget director and chief of staff for Donald Trump, Mick Mulvaney, in just a few moments on the other side of the next break. But one of the most troubling things, and this is, goes along with my theme of America greatness and America first and America the leader of the world, and strength at home means strength abroad. Once again, the Congressional Budget Office printed out their long-run estimates of the American economy, of our national economy, and once again showed numbers that were really scandalously low in terms of our ability or inability to grow or not to grow. The estimates are about 1.5%, slightly more than 1.5% per year for the next 10 years. And regrettably, that has been the pattern for the last 20 years plus. And I just want to remind how much better we can do and how much better we have done ever since World War II, for over 50 years, roughly from the end of World War II to the year 2000, the American economy grew at roughly 3.5%. This is after inflation. These are all so-called real numbers, after inflation. 3.5% for over 50 years. And since the year 2000, we've grown really by only about 1.5%. And so the Congressional Budget Office, as do most professional economists or academic economists, show only a continuation of 1.5%. And that's awful. I mean, we've had periods in this country like the 60s when we grew at over 4%. In the 80s and 90s when we grew at, 3.5 to 4%. And the last 20 years, 22 years, we've just dropped down to 1.5%. And we don't have to settle for that kind of low growth. I mean, what we want is rapid growth, greater prosperity. We need new incentives, lower taxes, less government spending, more limited government, fewer regulations. We want more opportunities. We want more opportunities for minority groups, but for everybody else. We want higher living standards for working folks and families, and better jobs, climb the ladder of success. We need resources. We need to develop more resources and new technologies and innovations. This is especially true in the energy sector, by the way, which is suffering mightily from some very bad woke leftist Green New Deal policies. I'm going to talk about this with Steve Koonin, the brilliant physicist who actually worked as President Barack Obama's chief energy department scientist 10 years ago or so. Steve Koonin will be on the show later on about what we must be doing on the energy field. But we need to deregulate energy. We need to deregulate business. We have to have the lightest touch, the lightest tax burden, the lightest regulatory burden, the lightest government spending burden. We need to protect the value of our currency. I call it King Dollar. We need to have price stability, not 8 or 10% inflation. We need to develop a balanced budget. We need to strive once again for a balanced budget. We have not had a balanced budget since the late 1990s, following a number of legislative deals between then-Speaker Newt Gingrich and then-President Bill Clinton, which came from something called the Contract with America. I've talked to Newt quite a bit. Newt's been on this show. I think he was on last week or the week before. I don't recall. A pro-growth balanced budget. Get away from all this woke progressivism, which really is, the difference here is a heavy-handed government, a government that wants to exercise state control over the economy. Lord help us from the central planners. Central planning is a socialist idea. Freedom of opportunity is a capitalist idea. We need to promote capital. We need to promote jobs. We need to promote business and stop vilifying these things. Here on Memorial Day weekend, think about that. We are a free country, but we must have a free economy. Right now, we have a very statist economy. It harkens back to the Road to Serfdom, written by Friedrich Hayek right after the war. Capitalism, free market capitalism, triumphed over central planning socialism. We need to keep it that way. We need to return to free market capitalism and entrepreneurship. We can grow at 3.5% per year. We have done it in the past. We can do it in the future. Think about that on Memorial Day. That will make us stronger at home and even stronger abroad. I'm Larry Kudlow. Mick Mulvaney on the other side.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. With great pleasure, we bring in a dear friend, Mick Mulvaney, former White House Chief of Staff. He was my chief. He's a former OMB Budget Director all during the Trump administration. He's also a former member of Congress. So, Mick Mulvaney, welcome back.
Morning, Larry. I like that intro, from Wall Street to the White House. Do we have to go back to Wall Street after that, or do we get to go back to the White House? How does that end?
I don't know. You tell me. You probably know more about that than I do. Anyway, this being Memorial Day, excuse me, Decoration Day, we want to make America great, preserving our freedoms. And, you know, Mick, the budget, the CBO budget came out. You're an expert on this. Once upon a time, I worked in the budget office a long while ago. And I just want to read a couple of numbers because, I mean, we're going to have to make radical changes, I think, in the budget story if we are to achieve much more rapid economic growth of 3.5%, which we had for 50 years after World War II, but we've slowed to 1.5%. So here's some quick numbers. The deficit is estimated to increase in the next 10 years by nearly $16 trillion. $16 trillion. Federal spending is the problem, not revenues. The government is set to spend 23.2% of GDP over the next decade. That is well above the 20.8% average of the prior 50 years, Mick. I mean, that's a big, big differential. And then just let me read a couple of quick ones. The $1 trillion infrastructure bill, which was never paid for, is now estimated to cost $678 billion more in outlays. So score that as 1.6 or 1.7 trillion. The omnibus appropriations bill was supposed to increase spending by $88 billion. It turns out it's been re-estimated. It's going to be $1.1 trillion, okay, with regulatory changes there and public health changes. Welfare is expected to rise by $315 billion more than original estimates. And the Obamacare premiums that were in the emergency bill, the Democrats passed $144 billion more over the next decade. I mean, these are outrageous numbers. One more number is this silly China competes bill that's going to make us more China than China, $350 billion. I mean, Mick, this is the stuff that has to be changed. And we could talk about a balanced budget, but I want to get your expertise. We can't go on like this. We cannot go on like this and fulfill prosperity.
No, you can't. And, of course, the difficulty that guys like you and I have is that we've been saying this for 20 years and it hasn't happened yet. But now you look at these numbers and go, holy cow, this is even worse than we thought it was going to be. Focus on a couple things there, because there's so many numbers. You and I both know we've done enough CBO projections together. We've not done enough budgets together. There's just an avalanche of numbers. I look at just a couple of them. You talked about revenues and expenses as a percentage of GDP. And that's the way to look at it, because the dollar today is not the same as the dollar in 1980, et cetera. When we passed the Trump tax cuts in 2017, the government was taking in about 17.5% of the GDP in tax revenues. That's how much money was coming in as a percentage of GDP. This year, they expect it to be 19.6% in the CBO projections. We cut taxes and grew government revenues. By the way, we are at a record on the percentage of taxes that we take in as a percent of GDP and the dollar amounts that come in. We have plenty of money. The other one we talked about, you just mentioned, is the expenditures as a percentage of GDP. The average over the last 50 years is just over 20%. If we had maintained that, Larry, we would be near a balanced budget this year. The spending is out of control.
Well, that's it. It's interesting. Even the CBO acknowledged the supply-side incentive effects from the Trump tax cut, especially the corporate tax cut. So we beat all those revenue estimates. And by the way, the CBO does acknowledge that the overly generous unemployment benefits and other related work benefits did, in fact, stop the labor market recovery. They actually said that. And they also had a pitch in there for workfare. I mean, CBO's come a long way, but even with all that, the spending is exploding. And I don't know, I mean, you know, if we were back in office, I would think we would want to put on the table a balanced budget plan, a pro-growth balanced budget plan that deals with the spending problem. But I don't hear that anymore. And the other one, I mentioned this to you when you were on the set for the TV show, you know, the word pay for. I never hear the word pay for. And I remember Rob Portman, of all people, a former budget director, a very smart guy, senator from Ohio, friend of ours. You know, Rob Portman was telling me with the infrastructure bill, well, even though it was scored as a huge deficit, they disregarded the number. Senator Mark Warner told me the same thing. He said, oh, we don't agree with those numbers. Yeah, okay, yeah. You don't agree with those numbers. Right. Well, here they are coming back even larger.
You know, it's hard to start on, you know, you don't want to sit here and spend all day pointing blame. But face it, we have not done the best job as a party. The Republican Party has not done as good a job as we can. To your point, we don't even talk about it much anymore. We're still talking about the 2020 election, for goodness sakes. I guess I'm now a moderate and a Republican and only name only because I think a balanced budget amendment is important and more important than rehashing the old election. But we've had our chances, and we didn't do as good a job as we could have. People forget that we had a balanced budget vote on the floor of the House, I think back in 2012 or 13, and our good friend Paul Ryan voted against it, mostly because it didn't have what he called the taxpayer protection against tax increases. But we've had the chance in the past and have not done it. I hope we get another chance again. I hope we get a chance to take the House here in a couple of months and the Senate, and then put Republican back in 2024 and prove to people that we do have the discipline to spend less. They've given us a couple chances in the past. We've not done as good as we possibly can. We're still doing better than Democrats by a wide margin.
Well, of course, the Democrats are into this modern monetary theory right now, that you can spend as much as you want and print as much money as you want, and it's going to all be okay. The trouble is it wound up with an 8 to 10% inflation rate.
I mean, you read the theory is actually very interesting. The theory is, and you and I have talked about this on the television program, which is the MMT is that you can spend, you can print as much money as you want as long as it doesn't create inflation. That's the thesis, right? Well, my question, and to you, and you and I shared this, was, okay, that's fine. That sort of looks backward over the last 40 years in this country and said, okay, that's actually happened. We've printed a bunch of money and it hasn't created a lot of inflation. But what happens when it does? And MMT doesn't answer that. And of course, here we are with where it does create inflation. So MMT ends now because it always said you can spend as much as you want to until you have inflation, but didn't say what to do after you have inflation because there is no coming back from printing all that dough other than spending a lot less.
Well, you need to call Joe Biden and tell him that it's over. MMT is over.
I need to call him and tell him that his OMB numbers are all wrong. I don't know if you know, you and I used to slave through these projections. The projections are the most interesting part of budgets and CBO documents. Not, you know, not where are we today. Everybody sort of knows where we are, but where do we think they're going to be? If you go into the CBO report, Larry, they'll show you that the Biden administration projections on GDP are way too high. Their projections on inflation are way too low. Their projections on unemployment are way too low. It's crazy. You and I would never have been able to get away with projections like the Biden team is putting out now when we were in the Trump administration.
Debt held in public hands is estimated to hit 109% of GDP at the end of the 10-year period. 109% of GDP. Now, I've never been the debt hawk or the deficit hawk that some people are in the Republican Party. I'm in the supply side wing of the public. I want us to grow, but we're not growing. And I guess I've softened on this because I didn't really anticipate 109% of GDP. That's a big number. That is such a big number, and it's so out of the usual boundaries that I'm not sure what the heck it's going to mean. I just know it can't be good.
Well, one of the things it means is that we're going to pay a larger and larger percentage of our revenues in interest. As your debt gets higher, we've benefited for the last 20 years, or at least the last 10, of our outrageously low, that near zero interest rate environment. And the government has been a huge beneficiary of that because it hasn't cost them very much to carry all of this debt. But at $30 trillion, you know, a 1% increase on your borrowing costs is $300 billion. That's a huge, huge number. And if you look at the CBO projections, even now they're still projecting that the inflation this year is only 2.4%.
Yeah.
So all the projections that you've seen could actually be much worse. Next year they say the interest on the 10-year will be 2.9. It's already at 2.8 as you and I have this conversation. So that interest as a percentage of what we spend is going to be bigger than everything in our budget other than Social Security, Medicare, and defense here in the next couple of years. And that's where you get to that crowding out, where we spend money on interest as opposed to spending it on other things or paying down the debt. We also crowd out with the private sector, of course. We talk about that later. But that interest is what people should be focused on because that is debilitating.
By the way, it's going to crowd out defense spending in the budget. And we're spending a lot of money on defense. I like that a lot. But nonetheless, all these factors will make it harder to spend on defense. And, Mick, Democrats, both parties have this thing now where Republicans want to spend more on defense, Democrats want to spend more on domestic. So what happens? We just spend more on both. All right, there's no discipline. There's no Graham Rudman targets. There's no sequestration. There's no nothing.
Yeah, I used to get people say, "Oh, why isn't there more bipartisanship in Washington D.C.?" And I said, "Listen, there's a great deal of bipartisanship on one or two issues." They said,
right.
"What are those?" I said, "Well, one is spending. Everybody likes spending money." You're right. There is a fiscal conservative wing of the party. I know they're there. I used to be one of them. But the center of gravity in Washington is to spend more. When the Republicans are in charge, we want to spend more on defense. And to get Democrat support for that, we give them more money for their social spending. When they're in charge, they want to spend more money on social spending, and they get our support by giving us a little bit more money for defense. That's the way the system has always worked. You never negotiate down in Washington. You always negotiate up. You don't get $30 trillion in debt because of one party. Washington has been doing this for a long time.
All right, let's take a quick break. Mick Mulvaney, former budget director, former chief of staff, former House member. I want to come back and talk about what we can do about this. We're going to have to deal with domestic spending, social spending. We're going to have to deal with some of these entitlements. And we're also going to have to grow the economy a whole lot faster to make up for revenues. Anyway, I'm Larry Kudlow, folks. We'll be right back with Mr. Mick Mulvaney.
Larry Kudlow on 77 WABC.
On a balanced budget plan for the America First Policy Institute, which we hope will be a roadmap. And again, it's not a tax hike plan. It would keep the Trump tax cuts, limit spending, deregulate, go back towards energy independence, have a strong dollar, and so forth. But to get there, we're going to have to make tough choices. And one of them is going to have to be on social spending, meaning the small entitlements, plus, Mick, the large entitlements. Medicare and Social Security. What can reasonably be done with those?
Yeah, that team that you just mentioned, you and Steve and Russ, there's some really, really sharp people in there. And I remember, can't remember which budget it was, but one of the proposals that we put together as a group was, okay, since there's no attitude in Washington towards cutting spending, let's just freeze it until revenues catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, I think the year that Russ took over for me as budget director, his budget offered a pathway to balance within the 10-year, what we call the 10-year budget window. My guess is that will be the last budget proposal for a long time from Democrats or Republicans that actually gets there, because it's just once you start spending all this money, it's hard to do. But Russ did some tremendous work. How do you do it, though, Larry? That's the more important. You know, we can all, again, not interested in laying blame. What do you do from here on out? You've just hit the nail on the head. Everything you've just described is the supply-side economic theory. And that's what we proved during the Trump administration works. If you lower taxes, try and put a little bit of restraint on spending, deregulate, have an aggressive pro-energy policy, you can have growth. You can have economic wealth for your friends and family. You can have the government with enough money to do business. You can have full employment, and you can have that without inflation. That's that magic formula that only the supply side has been able to give us. And I hope that's one of the lessons of the Trump administration that history writes, is that supply side works. And if any future administration is looking for a formula on how to fix the economy, it's sitting there between 2017 and 2021.
But even I don't think supply-side growth will balance the budget. I mean, I think there has to be some pretty tough limits on spending.
Yeah, that's right. That's why that approach of freezing spending until revenues catch up is probably the best chance that we have. By the way, keep in mind, in Washington, D.C., if you spend $100 on a program 1 year and then you spend $100 on that same program the next year, they call that a cut.
Yeah.
I'm not making that up. You know how the CBO baseline works, and the CBO will tell you, well, if you spent 100 last year, you're supposed to spend 103 this year, and if you don't, all the Democrats will run around saying you cut spending. I cannot tell you the number of times I stood in that podium in the White House and made arguments for freezing spending, and the reporters in the front row would immediately say, why are you cutting spending? So the language is even set up to spend more money in Washington.
Yep. So-called current services baseline. I once, many years ago, taught this to our friend, the late Rush Limbaugh, at a dinner. I don't know, it was in the early 90s or something, mid-90s. It's like going out, you go out to buy a car, you tell your wife you're going to buy a $75,000 car. So you actually go out and buy a $50,000 car. In Washington, that's regarded as a spending cut, even though you just spent 50 grand. Now, that view, I don't know how you change that. I remember John Kasich tried to change that. You know, we had all these amendments down through the years where we were going to eliminate the current services or the CBO baseline, but none of it ever got through. But you're saying the better reality is to go for a freeze, just freeze it. And that's an interesting thought as part of the plan.
That was built into part of our, you know, some of our proposals, just because we knew we couldn't get even members of our own party to sometime agree to cuts. If you could freeze spending, get efficiencies. Speaking of efficiencies, I had a conversation early on in my discussion with someone at the Pentagon about spending over there, and I asked them what they could do on efficiencies. You know, could they save any money? And they said, well, you know, last year we set a goal for 1% efficiency improvement, and we couldn't hit that. We couldn't hit that. So this year our new goal is 0%, and we're pretty sure we can meet that one. So
right.
If that's the attitude of the Defense Department, you know what it's going to be at the Department of Education, the Department of Commerce, you know, the EPA. Washington is not set up to spend less. It's not set up to freeze spending. It's set up to grow every single year. And you're right. You have to change the culture. You have to change the discussion. And maybe this new CBO report is shocking enough. It's gotten a good bit of press. Is shocking enough to sort of wake up even some conservative-leaning centrist Democrats to say, wait a second, maybe spending a lot more money right now is not the best thing. That's a win for fiscal conservatism between now and the election that we actually have a chance at.
Yeah, I mean, if spending is expected to be 24% of GDP, which is about 4 percentage points above the 50-year average, and that's a big number. And somebody's got to look at that and say, wait a minute, we can't permit this. I mean, that is a gigantic gap between the future and the past. I mean, that's how far off we are in budgeting. Now, that leads me to my last point. And I think Newt has pushed this, and he has prompted us to go into this balanced budget exercise, this planning thing that Russ Vogt's doing with the America First Policy Institute. I think, Mick, it's good to have a roadmap. I think it's good to have some sort of contract with America. Now, I know that Kevin McCarthy is developing one in the House. Mitch McConnell so far does not want one for the Senate. But let me just lay this on you. I don't think these things are necessarily great campaign weapons. I don't think the contract with America itself was a big campaign thing. I think, though, they're vitally important if you recapture, if the GOP recaptures both houses, if the cavalry does come, the cavalry needs a plan from day one. That's the point that I think Newt is making, and I think it's a good point.
It is. And listen, I got nothing but faith in Russ. He was a great director of the Office of Management and Budget. And, you know, we used to describe Newt as an idea machine. I mean, he'd come up with 10 or 12 a day. Just keeping up with him was a full-time job sometimes. So, yeah, you're right. We need it not only to educate the public. We need to educate our own members. A lot of members of Congress don't know how to talk about the economy. They don't know how to talk about deficits. And that's fine. I mean, if you've got a military background or a education background, you might not be familiar with things like percentage of GDP and all that. We need to educate our own members so when they're out talking to the constituents, we can start to change the culture in our party and maybe the culture nationwide to where people don't want to spend a bunch of money because they now recognize that it costs them in inflation. I saw there's an article yesterday about the Democrats complaining that Biden's proposed $10,000 student loan cut wasn't enough. It's a go small, get rid of it all. And I'm like, please let the Democrats run on that, because I think the American public is learning you cannot spend all of this money without having some inflation in the current environment. And that may help the Republicans politically, but also may help us change the discussion.
Well, that's the thing. The day after the election, after the celebrations, you have to have a roadmap. What to do. You cannot, I mean, if we capture both houses, Mick, and it's business as usual, and we're negotiating or talking about just little marginal changes, that's not going to work. In other words, somebody's got to come in with a plan. Here's what we're going to do. To me, it's the planning exercise as much or more than the election exercise. You got to be able to take the bit and just say, okay, here's where we're going to go. That, I think, is the point about the balanced budget plan.
Yep. We had a thing called Simpson Bowles, a decade and a half ago, though it had some weaknesses in it because it had a bunch of tax increases. But just going through that exercise is helpful. And I can't tell you, Larry, when we were on the floor of the House debating the budget back in 2011 and 12, how many times, you know, members were able to go to that report, that Simpson Bowles report, because the work had already been done. So stuff you and Rush are doing is great. Keep it up.
Thank you, Mick Mulvaney. Terrific stuff. We need a big change in Washington. Got to change the swamp. Make America stronger. Give us some growth. We're going to take a quick break. On the other side of the break, we're going to talk about the energy crack-up right now. The energy crack-up and how to fix it. I'm Kudlow. Please stick around.
WABC. Hi, it's Ernie Anastas. You know, your thoughts can affect how you feel, and how you feel can impact your thoughts. Addressing your mind and body connection is the key to improving your overall wellness. Bergen Newbridge Medical Center is the largest hospital in New Jersey, providing comprehensive, equitable, compassionate, and high-quality emergency inpatient and outpatient medical care, plus mental health services and substance use disorder treatment. The Bergen Newbridge team can address your total health needs in one convenient location. Call 201-225-7130. For an appointment, or newbridgehealth.org.
WABC.
This is the news and talk station of New York with Larry Kudlow.
Stop meddling with it.
Real New York, 77 WABC. It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show, and you can live stream us across the country, around the world, and throughout the solar system. Just go to LarryKudlowShow.com. All right, Memorial Day weekend, gasoline prices across the country, AAA, $4.60. That is an American record. Diesel prices, $5.53. I think that's close to a record. Diesel prices are used by truckers, and truckers deliver over 70% of goods around this country. So there's been a lot of assertions made recently at Davos, and President Biden was in Japan lauding high gasoline prices. So it's time for my Steve Coonan fix. That's what it is. Steve Coonan is a former Obama Energy Department chief scientist. He's currently a professor at New York University, NYU. He was at Caltech for many, many years. He is the author of Unsettled, What Climate Science Tells Us, What It Doesn't, and Why It Matters. Mr. Steve Coonan, welcome back to the show.
Oh, great to be talking with you on this Memorial Day weekend, Larry.
Yes, thank you. So, Steve, there's a lot of things to cover. One of them is Joe Biden in Japan. He was asked about high gasoline prices, and he's now he's calling this an incredible transition. He's saying this incredible transition. He doesn't deny the high gasoline prices. I don't think it's particularly bothersome to him. I know it's a political issue, but you and I aren't here to talk politics. He says incredible transition, and then he said, God willing, when it's over, we'll be stronger, and the world will be stronger. What he means by that is we will get to some kind of net zero carbon, and we will no longer use fossil fuels. And my thought is, God willing, we'll still have an economy if we don't use fossil fuels. So I want you to weigh in, if you would, please, from all of your different work. How bad is the fossil fuel story? How bad is the climate story? How bad are, you know, individual men and women who may have contributed to global warming? But what does it all mean?
Boy, you know, it's really complicated, Larry. But let me start in on, first of all, gasoline or fuel more generally is the lifeblood of the economy. And the high prices that we're currently experiencing impose terrible burdens on most Americans. Some folks are, of course, well enough off that it's not such a big deal, but for the great majority of Americans, it raises not only their individual costs, but the cost of everything we buy. Now, is that, as the president says, ultimately a benefit? I think nobody ever does a cost-benefit analysis of decarbonization. And when you do that, or you try to do that, the answer is not so obvious. Yes, we will perhaps have a little bit less risk from climate, but it's a few percent of the GDP at the end of the century, whereas the costs and the disruption of making this kind of transition, not just for the U.S., the whole globe has got to do it, are significant. And it's not obvious which way it comes out, but either way, it's pretty small.
I mean, are we in an existential threat, an immediate existential threat mode from the use of carbon?
No, of course not. Of course not. The official reports don't say that at all. In fact, as I said, it's a few percent, according to them, of the GDP in 2100, equivalent to a couple years of growth. Hmm. So anybody who uses the word existential either hasn't read the reports or is being disingenuous.
What, 2%, 2.5 degrees Celsius warmer by the end of the 21st century compared to the late 1800s? You wrote that in one of your op-ed pieces.
Yep.
What does that mean? I mean, why should I worry about that?
Well, the answer is, in the very long term, it might cause more melting of the ice sheets and hence a more rapid rise of the ocean than we might see otherwise. But when I say very long term, I'm talking about a couple centuries. We will see longer growing seasons. Some areas of the globe might become a little bit less comfortable to live in, but we adapt. And, you know, as I think I said to you once before, we've seen already 1.1 degrees of rise in the last century, and the globe has done more than just fine in terms of health, population, longevity, nutrition, and so on. So another 1 degree over a century, not going to make a big deal at all.
Yeah, that sort of brings me to what climate czar John Kerry talked about at Davos, and he went through all the alleged damages and catastrophes from hurricanes and, you know, other natural disasters. He had a whole spiel about this. So I went back and looked at what our friend Bjorn Lomborg has written. Lomborg says that all these hurricanes and natural disasters, that the loss of human lives from these hurricanes and disasters has fallen 99% over the last 100 years. Literally, between 1920 and 2020, 99% drop in human lives lost through these hurricanes and other disasters. So I say Mr. Kerry is exaggerating. How's that?
I think that's one way to say it. Another is that he's being disingenuous. You know, I've never met the Honorable Mr. Kerry. I assume he knows a lot about diplomacy. But I don't think he knows very much at all about climate or energy. And so he's got to read and he's got to listen to others. He might be very selective in what he's reading or listening. Maybe he's not even read the official reports. But when you do, I think they validate what Bjorn has written and I have written as well.
I mean, what can... All right, one more point. I had Scott Pruitt on the TV show this past week. He's former EPA commissioner. Now, one of the things that he talked about was when the U.S. government is measuring the environmental impact of things, you know, whether it's oil or gas or pipelines. I mean, they're talking about direct impact, Steve. They're talking about indirect impact. They're talking about cumulative impact. Pruitt says, what about technological advances? And he mentioned one that's very interesting, carbon capture and storage. And in general, the point is technology has made these carbon fuels, particularly natural gas, cleaner and cleaner, not dirtier and dirtier. And this is this information is not being modeled properly by the EPA or the Interior Department or the Energy Department.
Yeah, I mean, the burning of any fossil fuel, but particularly natural gas, will produce carbon dioxide. We do have the technology to capture that carbon dioxide after the burning and make sure it doesn't get into the atmosphere. The problem is it's pretty expensive. We can work to develop technologies to make that less expensive, but it's still going to be more expensive always than just letting it go up into the air.
But if we have strong economic growth and we, you know, producing the resources, let's call it the financial resources, as well as the technology breakthroughs, then, you know, we stand a good chance of being able to apply these new inventions.
Yeah, and we can. And, of course, we need the research and demonstration to bring down the cost. And we could do it in the U.S. If there's enough political will and financial capital to do it. The problem with carbon in the atmosphere is it's got to be done over the whole globe to be effective. And remember, the U.S. is only 13% of emissions.
I want to talk about that in a minute. Let's take a quick break. We have Steve Koonin, who is now at NYU. He's former Obama's Energy Department chief scientist, Caltech before that. I want to talk exactly about how to bring the globe down. And what would a world look like without carbon-related fuel and power? I'm Larry Kudlow. This is The Larry Kudlow Show. We'll be right back.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show on 77 WABC. Now back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're talking to Steve Koonin, former Obama Energy Department chief scientist, currently professor at NYU. His book is Unsettled, What Climate Science Tells Us, What It Doesn't, and Why It Matters. Steve Koonin, the lead editorial in today's Wall Street Journal is America's Summer of Rolling Blackouts, green energy policies are making the nation's electric power grid increasingly unstable. Now, look, here's my thought. If we keep taking down, if government policies keep thwarting the use of fossil fuels, in this case it has a lot to do with natural gas, the substitutes, particularly wind turbines and storage, are not resilient, they're not dependable, and this is an example of jamming down an end to fossils. We don't have a replacement mechanism, and it will do great damage to the economy. That is my thought. Please tell me what's yours.
You know, I think you're right, Larry, and I've become increasingly worried over the last year that we're going much too fast without a real plan. You know, the energy system is so important, it's not to be messed with lightly. And there is no plan other than we got to get rid of fossil fuels.
Right.
And replace them with wind and solar. I mean, serious studies have shown you just can't do that and maintain the reliability and affordability of the grid. It's going to take many decades if you want to make an emissions-free grid that's also reliable and affordable. We don't need to rush it.
I mean, the other point is, let's take natural gas. If we were increasing our exports of natural gas, let's say to China, let's use China, wouldn't that make, I mean, if China used natural gas instead of coal, that would be a big factor in bringing down global emissions. I could say the same about India, which is another big carbon emitter. Okay, substituting natural gas for coal would be a great policy to achieve even these so-called Paris Climate Accord goals, would it not?
Yes, absolutely. Natural gas emits only about half the carbon dioxide that coal does per unit energy produced, and so it's a wonderful thing. The problem is that while it's abundant in the U.S., fortunately, and we could produce a lot more, many other countries, particularly China, don't have, and I think India as well, don't have those resources at the scale needed. So they would, if you like, become dependent upon the U.S. For natural gas. I'm not so sure China would be happy about that.
Yeah, well, it'd be worth a shot.
Yeah.
you're probably right. But, I mean, you've written just in general that, you know, these environmental models that are being used and the current the Biden administration is just very heavy now in these environmental impact statements, but they're using models. The models, I think, don't even capture the potential for future technology breakthroughs. But you've said just looking at the past, the models aren't any good.
Indeed. There's a guy named Bjorn Stevens who runs Germany's Institute for Meteorology. And he said recently, in fact, it's difficult and in many places impossible to scientifically advise societal efforts to adapt in the face of unavoidable warming. It's impossible to assess the extent to which a given degree of warming poses existential threats. There are other people who are saying the same thing. The models give us a fuzzy picture of what goes on globally, but they're practically worthless to talk about what happens in any particular place or region.
So if we acknowledge, I mean, we're not denying climate impact. If we acknowledge climate impact, Steve Koonin, over the next 50 years or the next 100 years, with respect to GDP, it's not that big a deal is what you're saying.
No, it's a few percent for 3 degrees of warming.
And so suppose I tell you that I could cut taxes or deregulate various business and commercial activities, which would release, you know, entrepreneurship and faster growth. Suppose I posit that. That could offset whatever climate change is going on.
Absolutely. And the IPCC says that. The UN reports say that there are many other factors, some of which you just listed, that are more important than climate change in determining economic growth. And so I would love to ask the Honorable Mr. Kerry, you know, the IPCC says that. Mr. Kerry. Do you deny that?
Well, I'm going to call him right after the show.
Okay, that would be great. I'd love to hear the answer.
And talk to, I used to know him, but not so much in recent years. I mean, I don't have... I just wrote a column about this. A fossil-free economy will be in a permanent recession. We are not ready for that kind of thing. It's the unknown. It's like, you know, in the Middle Ages, the earth was flat, and they would draw these maps, and then the map would end, and it would be, you know, the rest of the map would say, there be dragons, because no one knew what was the... I mean, that's kind of what this is like. There'll be dragons.
It is. It's uncharted territory, if you want to be literal about it.
Yeah.
I expect that we would, over a century, readjust to having a fossil-free economy, but there would be great inequities because you've got to worry about the 5 billion people who don't have enough energy.
Mm.
And it would be, we'd spend more for energy than we're doing currently.
And so my last question goes away from fossils. I want to go to nuclear. I want to go to nuclear power, which many people, that is the ultimate renewable, nuclear power. Now, the advocates, you know, Ms. Kerry doesn't like nuclear power. The advocates, the hardliners on climate change don't like nuclear power. What about nuclear power? Shouldn't that be part of the mix?
Yeah. So again, as I may have told you before, I'm a nuclear physicist by training.
Yes.
So I have a great affinity for fission. But look, you've got a lot of people, including the EU, Stuart Brandt, the author of the Whole Earth Catalog, Michael Schellenberger, who have great environmental credentials, who have come to understand what many of us have long understood, and that is if you want an emissions-free energy system, fission, nuclear power, has got to be an important part of the picture. It's a proven technology. It can be made, I believe, economic. The waste issues or spent fuel issues are manageable. The world will eventually decide it's got to do this if it wants to be emissions-free.
Would nuclear power be absolutely central, like the biggest part of an emissions-free world?
Well, we're going to need a mix. I think gas with carbon capture and storage or big batteries, large storage, will also be part of it. But you've got to have that reliable source of electricity that you can turn on when the wind and solar are not generating, as can happen for weeks at a time. And I think the best way to do that is fission. And I believe the world will eventually come to realize that.
What is the biggest hang-up right now? Is it just the psychology of some of the disasters, or what?
Yeah, I think it's two or three things. One is that the current cost is very high. The big nuclear reactors are very expensive, largely because of the need to license them individually. If we can get to factory-produced small reactors, that need goes away.
Right.
We can bring down the cost.
Steve Koonin. I got to stop it. Steve Koonin, you are terrific. Actually, you got to come back on the TV show. We'll have this conversation and more. Thanks so much.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Dear, dear friend, Kellyanne Conway is here. We've known each other a long time, worked together on projects. Former Trump senior counselor, and she was the campaign chairman and campaign manager for the Trump-Pence campaign in 2016, founded the polling company, now runs KAC Consulting, if I have that right, and most importantly, brand new book, hot off the press. It's a terrific book. Here's the deal, a memoir. It's a great... Kellyanne, I actually, when I see you Wednesday, I've read a pretty good chunk of the book. And all I'll say is, somebody who's written a couple of books, good for you. Good for you. It's a good read. Very good read.
Thank you, Larry. As you know, these are labors of love. And this is my memoir. Even though I'm only 55, God willing, I have decades of life ahead of me. But people are very interested in the story behind the stories. And that means just the way I was raised. Was I raised to be a Republican? Did I come from a political family? What is my background? What do I see as the future for those 74 million Trump voters who are really hurting under the Biden-Harris economy now, very frustrated with what they see happening across this country, and frankly weren't there on January 6th inside the Capitol and don't like being denigrated and castigated by the mainstream media and some of the never-Trumpers. So really, this book also lays out all the Trump accomplishments, of which you had a big hand in helping to make so. And I wanted to record them for all time. I know President Trump and Vice President Pence and others talk about them routinely. They're Trump accomplishments. They would not have happened without his leadership and his moxie and his political outsider businessman's instinct to get things done with a ferocity and a velocity that often escapes Washington. But I wanted to put them here because people should know that in the Trump White House, as you know, Larry, all of us had access to the president. We were in and out of the Oval Office, in and out of briefings and meetings. And I think the way he operated was just much more transparent and much more accessible to the people around him and, frankly, to the American people. Whether you liked his tweets or not, he put out an instant, free-of-charge communication to the American people routinely. They always knew what he was thinking. And you know what, Larry? In the White House where you and I worked, nobody ever had to ask the questions, who's in charge and what does the president really think?
Isn't that the truth? You know, that point, a lot of us had really, you're right, unlimited open access to the president. And he liked that a lot. You know, the other thing that occurs to me, so you're sitting there in some policy discussion and all of a sudden he decides he wants to bring somebody in from the outside, right? So he calls to Molly or whoever in the outer oval, and he gets somebody else on the phone and includes them in the conversation to add to the conversation. Now, I have no idea whether Biden does anything like that or not, but I always thought that was very cool. Sometimes he had several people add to the conversation. And, you know, this was not national security stuff. This is usually domestic policy stuff. But he was in total touch with everybody. He loved to have as many inputs as possible.
That's right. And that's the mark of a leader. A leader comfortable in his skin who's going to execute on the promises, deliver on the promises he made to the American people. So I know what you're talking about. Pick up the phone. People get involved. They're getting a call from President Trump. They can hardly believe it. But they were made for a moment like that, Larry. People who had been working on surprise medical billing or health care or health transparency or school choice or an alternative to Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, people had been working on that for years, and they were expert in their field. And to get a call and be consulted by the President of the United States, I think the more inputs, the better, so long as you have a leader like Donald Trump who then weighs all the options and consequences, hears all of the credible information, considers it, and then makes the decision. Because after all, his name and Mike Pence's name were on the ballot. Larry Kudlow, Kellyanne Conway were not on the ballot. The buck stops with him. He made the decisions. And as you know, there were some policy debates I lost. But I at least knew I had a boss who heard me, who listened, who respected our opinions, and who solicited them. I have to answer your other question. I have no confidence that that's the standard operating procedure for most White Houses and most mm-hmm. West Wings, least of all this one. I mean, how can you explain 13 senior officials in Vice President Kamala Harris's office already have left? Mm. Think about that. These are dream jobs that she's turned into a nightmare. So if they felt that they were being heard, that the briefing material they put together was being absorbed and assimilated and acted upon, I suspect they would have stayed the way you and I stayed.
Mm. Dream jobs, by the way. Dream jobs is exactly right. It was a dream job. Mine was a dream job. I loved that job in EC. I loved that job. And, of course, you were right across the hall in the set. What did you call it? The cool kids were on the
second cool kids
floor.
Wing. And you were the coolest and biggest cool king of all, my friend. You had Ivanka Trump right there, White House counsel. We were the cool kids wing. I have a story, and you know how this was. I have a story in the in the book where the president solicits me to the Oval Office one day, and Tom hands me my folder, and I'm ready to go. Okay, I have it all tabbed, everything we've been talking about, everything he's been asking about, things I want to raise with him. And I walk in, and it's a totally different conversation.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
And he asks me, he said, did you see my tweet? And I said, my goodness, Mr. President, it takes me 12 seconds to get here in 3-inch heels. I don't know. Did I miss it? And, you know, classic case. But, you know, Larry, as you full well appreciate, and everyone should acknowledge, that way of governing, that pace, is not for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I do think some people couldn't do it. They got squeezed out, never got there to begin with, fired or slinked away or just left on their own accord, whatever it was. But there was a certain Darwinism at work in that White House and that West Wing for many different reasons. But you just said something important I want to amplify and explain from Kellyanne Conway's perspective. I thought that was a dream job, senior counselor in the president in the White House, because like you, it's a public, like you, you appreciate a public service job. So you and I gave up 7 figures, maybe more, to be there. And I never looked back. I never even thought about the money lost. I never, because you see that you're in the thick of it. And it's not your name in lights. It's that you're doing something that affects so many people with positive consequence. That Tax Cut and Jobs Act that you worked on before you, just months before you actually came into a formal, in a formal capacity, that created so much growth, Larry Kudlow word, and wealth for everyday Americans. Everybody got relief out of that Tax Cut and Jobs Act, repatriating wealth and jobs that are parked legally overseas, and that deregulation agenda and energy independence. The list goes on and on, and these just aren't sound bites to prove the efficacy and the success of the Trump administration. That's a given. Anybody can read a list. It's to really bring people inside the room and see how these decisions were made. Larry, there were a couple big people who didn't like it. The never-Trumpers, some of whom had worked in White House, some who never have, mainly because they lost the races they worked on. But I don't think they had the kind of access to the principles we did. I don't think they had the kind of seat at the table, and you can hear that in their criticisms. Number two, and most of all, the middleman did not like the fact that Donald Trump cut out the middleman. And the middleman is the media. They didn't like it. I think their job is to get the story, but most days they thought their job was to get the president and his family and the people around them and their families. And I think folks like you and me, I mean, you're the expert here. You have your own television show. Again, you did for years, and now you do again. God bless you. Highest rated show. Everybody watches it. Must-see TV. And you know what, Larry? I think we were a little bit more accustomed to how to deal with the media. But I got gobbled up. Those first couple of months were very difficult on me and my children, who would see people writing things about their mother that were unrecognizable. And I think all of that was unfortunate for a very simple reason, that if you have any – kind of distraction, disruption, people just throwing logs in the way of the president's agenda, it hurts the country. And if you look back, chapter 30 of my new book, Here's the Deal, is called Collusion, Illusion, Delusion. It's all about the 2.5+ years of this Russian, as the president clearly rightly says, hoax. And it just wasted time and money and angst, all those young people who had a lawyer up, and for what? Here we are. Anything that we know about Russia collusion, delusion, had to do with the Hillary people, had to do with the DNC. So people may say, why are you bringing that up again? Because it's in the news right now, the Sussman trial. It's in the news because people should know Donald Trump got all that done amidst this constant assault on him and his
right.
and his work.
That's a key point. And it all, every bit of it was a damn lie. Every single bit of it. But your point there, he had an ability to compartmentalize all of that nonsense, even though it ate at him and gnawed away at him and it made him furious, and he was right to be furious because all a bunch of damn lies, but he still got all this other stuff done, which is really quite remarkable. We're talking to Kellyanne Conway, and the name of the book is Here's the Deal, a memoir. I want to sell a lot of books today on radio. One click on Amazon, undoubtedly. Kellyanne, just for this part, I was up until 2 in the morning reading particularly the chapter on 2020. That was our toughest year with the pandemic. Have you ever seen a challenge like that before in your career lifetime?
Never. It was a challenge within a conundrum, within a near impossibility. And I think the president handled it very well. I know there are people in his ear now reinventing history and what's said in this particular book, but here are the facts. I have this whole chapter in there where he calls me on New Year's Eve going into 2020, and I think, you know, what can possibly go wrong? It's going to be a great year. And then, of course, we're hit with a once-in-a-century global pandemic. We're hit with we're hit with a reelection campaign that had to, and I think, frankly, never successfully did shift over to a new policy set to make sure people knew everything that this president and the White House, the administration, were doing to help mitigate the damage and save lives when it came to COVID. No one else in the Oval Office would have and could have, in my view, Larry, gotten those pharmaceutical companies and the private sector and the public sector to work together to develop therapeutics and vaccines in record time. Mm-hmm. There's no way, in less time than it takes to have a baby, Larry Kudlow, they got those shots in the arm. Only Donald Trump with Operation Warp Seed. And really just the ventilator cupboards were bare. There weren't enough masks and PPE and the PPP you worked on just to make sure our small businesses and many other institutions stayed afloat. So there was so much going on that we were trying to figure out day by day. And listen, respectfully, the president was listening to the doctors. And the doctors had a lot of mixed messages, particularly at the beginning. Don't wear a mask. That would look ridiculous. The WHO itself, on Twitter, of course, of all things, said that China assured them, there is no human-to-human transition. Mm-hmm. Dr. Fauci saying that viruses like that do not present through asymptomatic spread. I mean, none of this ended up being true. So I think the best thing would have been, even for the doctors and scientists, to say, here is what we think we know, but we're still finding out, and we'll bring you along. And then you had the George Floyd murder and the civil unrest and the riots that followed, the reelection campaign, $1.4 billion. I just think they should have focused more on policy. Yeah. And I'm sorry that they came up short when it was time for the electors to certify the election. I'm heartbroken that he's not in there.
Well, so am I, by the by. I want to talk about that. Got to take a quick break. Folks, the name of the book is Here's the Deal, a memoir. The author is Kellyanne Conway. There's no smarter person on politics and policy than Kellyanne Conway. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to be right back because perhaps President Trump is going to go and run again and complete some unfinished business. Stay with us, please.
Larry Kudlow on 77 WABC. Now back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. I'm talking to dear friend Kellyanne Conway, former Trump senior counselor and campaign manager in the 2016 run. She's got a great new book out. I was up late last night reading it because I only got it really yesterday. Anyway, it's called Here's the Deal, a memoir. One click on Amazon. We got to sell a million books. Radio is a great way to sell books, Kellyanne. Kellyanne, I'm just making a quick list here. Closing the border, ringing the bell on the China threat, tax cuts and growth, and especially for the minorities, protecting the unborn, appointing constitutionalist judges, and Operation Warp Speed. I'm sure there's stuff that I'm forgetting. Vladimir Putin stayed home, okay? No adventurism while Trump was president. So all of that, despite, as you mentioned before the break, the constant press attacks and the whole Russian business, which was a complete fat lie from day one, you said on the TV show when you came on that he would like to run again and he's got some unfinished business. It's the unfinished business part that was really interesting to me. Tell us what you're thinking.
Sure, Larry. So obviously President Trump was preparing for a second term. We all wished he would have gotten one. We all wish he was there right now. There's no doubt. And the we isn't just the people who worked around him or folks who call themselves Republicans or conservatives. If you look at everybody's polling, Larry, including the mainstream media's polls, it now includes a healthy majority of Republicans, independents, young people, seniors, junior seniors, as I call them, suburban women, they're hurting under the Biden-Harris administration. So that unfinished business would really be to expand some of the gains from the first term and to try to get that to get the House and the Senate back so that he can have a Republican House and a Senate rather than the Democratic House and Senate hell-bent on trying to impeach him twice and whatnot and worry about things that don't really affect Americans. And get more stuff done. I think a permanent and much better replacement for government-run health care, another tax cut for individuals and employers. I think doing more on education, school choice, charters. Listen, we all know that we already believe that. President Trump ran on repealing Common Core, expanding school choice. But after the pandemic, Larry, you know how many parents and non-parents and the students themselves felt screen time and school time was just a little too much, went on a little too long. I think that the president would love to be the leader who presides over an expansion of school choice and chars educational freedom so that every child in this country has an opportunity to access education that is worthy of their humanity and dignity. And then look abroad. Putin was not in Ukraine. Iran was not, as a nuclear-capable country, salivating at our best friend Israel. China was, you know, China had been brushed back. There was an enforceable, verifiable, specific trade deal that you had an awful lot to do with. Trade deals with Korea, Japan, Mexico, Canada. So when you look at what he did do, he would have continued to do that and do more of it. So I know there's unfinished business. And the second thing is he's got the best contrast available to Joe Biden on policy. He can say to Americans, look, I know you hope it does get better, but folks, remember, it was better not that long ago because I was there. Simple message, if he's willing to deliver it.
You know, I think that two things. One is another Trump presidency would stop the woke cultural stuff, I'm just going to call it. Stop it. All these values that they're instilling trying to instill in the kids. I think Trump would back the parents against the school boards and the teachers' unions. He would have generated, you know, strong values, America first type values, go back to the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We've gotten so far off the beaten track. Stop all the talk about gender. Stop all the talk about sex, particularly with, you know, young kids, five-year-old kids. A bunch of us are working right now. We had Mick Mulvaney on this show earlier. Russ Vogt and I and Steve Moore and Kevin Brady and Brooke Rollins, we're putting together a pro-growth balanced budget plan which would remedy America's finances, which are in very sad shape right now. I think that would be a second, you know, another term for Trump. We could get that done. So there is plenty of work to be done. Let me also, just before I lose you, let me go back something. In terms of the 2020 election, the coronavirus, the pandemic, he never got credit enough for Operation Warp Speed. How much do you think the pandemic played in the 2020 election?
I'm very clear about that in the book. I think it allowed things like Zuckbucks to help rig the election, meaning when I saw that Dave Bossy, Citizens United movie Rigged, and I'm in it, President Trump is in it. In fact, there is a part in it where President Trump is talking to Dave Bossy, explains all the malfeasance and improprieties, and then says, and we lost. Those are his words. And I say right in there that when I saw that movie, the president said, what did you think? I said, Mr. President, I saw that movie, and I'm surprised you won Mississippi, meaning the fix was in many places. If you're going to spend $400 million and if every grant of $1 million plus ended up going for COVID-compelled voting measures to 92% of the districts that Joe Biden won, Larry, then you see that, of course, there was malfeasance afoot. I also think it affected it in another way. COVID was a reason for us to do the stop the spread, stay at home, get the kids out of school, surge the supplies, as you've said, et cetera. But COVID went from being a reason to an excuse for many of these left-wingers who knew they had a turkey of a candidate in Joe Biden. Just as they had a turkey of a candidate in Hillary Clinton, and they tried to cheat, lie, and steal, including this Russia collusion steal dossier, Sussman nonsense. They did it with COVID in 2020. They used that as an excuse for what, Kellyanne? Oh, universal mail ballots, ballot harvesting, right, violating the chain of custody. In Pennsylvania, the election officials, who are not officially elected to anything, Larry Kudlow, they allowed people to deliver ballots long past the due date, long past the hour in which you're supposed to collect them. So, there were things going on all over the country. It's just too bad that the $1.4 billion 2020 campaign never adapted away from the roaring economy, energy independence, reelection onto, you know, really having election observers in place, maybe ring cameras in the back alley if you want to see if anybody's bringing, you know, bipartisan measures that would restore faith in the election process. But look, President, I write in the book, President Trump himself had sounded the alarm bell in April, maybe May. I think it was April of 2020. And he said, Larry, if they allow mail-in ballots, we're going to lose. Yep. They can cheat. He said that early, and I really think those who were in charge
Should have jumped on it. That election, it's funny, it's not the recounting of fraudulent votes. It was the fact that election was rigged before the voting ever took place, where as you say, Zuckbucks, they put $400 or $500 million into hiring Democratic operatives into swing districts so that the mail-in ballots and the harvesting of that ballots would take place.
That's right.
Fraudulent ballots to begin with. And you're right. So the derivative of mail-in ballots was COVID. I mean, the COVID became a reason, and they're trying to make it permanent now.
Well, that's the real problem here, Larry. That's the real problem here, if you ask me, my friend, and I write about it in the book. If we make permanent and codify and institutionalize these COVID-compelled, once-in-a-century pandemic measures, we're cooked. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of Republican governors and state legislatures are allowing this to happen. I think all the focus on 2020 has also sort of interrupted the need for speed in terms of making sure it doesn't happen in 2022 and, of course, 2024. Hey, Larry, if all these differences were done because of a once-in-a-century pandemic, talk to me again in 98 years about how to handle it. It should not be that way now. And back to one quick thing you said, because you'll never really take the full credit. America First Policy Institute, the AFPI, Brooke Rollins, Linda McMahon, you, and so many others, working on policy, that is the linchpin. That is the key that unlocks the door.
Well, you've come in with us.
I have. I'm the chair of the Center on the American Child, but I think the work is great and it's substantive, and the American people are starving for it.
The name of the book, Here's the Deal, a memoir. The author, Kellyanne Conway. Thank you, Kellyanne. Love. We'll talk soon, folks.
Thank you, Larry.
I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to do some stock market work. A very good week for the stock market. Maybe it's a relief rally. We'll talk about it. Please stick around. I'm Kudlow.
WABC.
This is the news and talk station of New York with Larry Kudlow.
Stop meddling with it.
Real New York, 77 WABC. It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. Join us during the week, Fox Business. 4 to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. The name of the show is Kudlow. And you can live stream us here, LarryKudlowShow.com, on the Internet, throughout the country, around the world, and throughout the solar system. We need to talk about this big stock market week. My goodness, the Dow Jones was up almost 2,000 points. The NASDAQ up 777 points, and the S&P 500 257 points. So that's big. And also, interest rates are coming down, despite the fact that Jay Powell, the Fed chair, has been telling us how tough the Fed is going to be about inflation. We still have lots of inflation. He's growing hair in his chest. And yet the market is saying, no, rates are going down, not up. Stocks are going up, not down. So, to explain all of this, we have Stephanie Link, Chief Investment Strategist of Hightower Advisors and Head of Investment Solutions, and Nancy Tengler, CEO and Chief Investment Officer, Laffer Tengler Investments, which has a 5-star Morningstar rating, which means she knows what she's doing. I think she knows what she's doing. I hope so. Same with Stephanie. All right, kids, big week. Is this a relief rally? Or is this the beginning of something new and wonderful? I begin with you, Stephanie Link.
Well, I think it is a relief rally for the time being, because yeah. I do think that I think that there's still a lot of unknowns, Larry. I mean, you touched on it, right? Interest rates are coming down. The core PCE yesterday, which is the inflation metric that we know the Fed looks at, looks like it has peaked. I think it's too early to say that, but that's what people are thinking. It came in at 4.9% year over year versus 5.2% year over year last month. So it does look like it is in the kind of peakish area. And then, of course, the market now, as a result of both of those things, expects Powell and team to be easier. The Atlanta Fed, as we know, came out with a revised GDP number this week of 1.8% for the second quarter. And that is down. It was north of 2% beforehand. So we're seeing a slowdown. We're seeing inflation hit some of the consumers. And we're seeing some of the hiring that we've been hearing about, that we're getting hiring freezes. So I think you have a relief rally because maybe the Fed is not as draconian, but I just think it's too early to say that with any kind of certainty. That being said, I just say one thing. I'm sure Nancy has seen this, too, and observed this, too. The Russell 1000 Growth Index is down. Even with the rally this week, it's down 21% year-to-date. The Russell 1000 value is only down 4% year-to-date. So you've had this past week a reversion back to growth, back to technology, because if you think that the Fed is not going to be that tight and growth is going to slow, you're going to want to own growth. I think all that's premature, but that's what's going on.
Yeah, go ahead, Nancy Tengler. What do you think?
Well, first, I want to thank you for your intro on Decoration Day, Larry. I come from a long line of military service, and that was sobering and much needed. So, thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm so glad you asked Stephanie first. I could sit back and say, oh. I do agree for the most part. However, we have been suspicious, and you and I have sort of gone back and forth on this a little bit, that the Fed would be able to raise as much as indicated. They've done a fantastic – this is one area I'll compliment them on. They've done a fantastic job in using rhetoric to encourage the market to do the heavy lifting. And that's exactly what's happened. The bond market has raised rates while the Fed was just talking about it. And now we hear Bullard say, well, we may take a pause in September. September is pretty darn close to the midterm elections. Call me a cynic. I think that's probably a little bit politically driven. And we've sort of stopped the bleeding from an earnings standpoint. This has been – I've characterized this as the sell everything on the news market. And I imagine Steph would agree with this to some extent. You know, we saw Snapchat miss on or warn on advertising. Well, they had already missed earnings on April 21st, and suddenly the market took Facebook down 10%. Snapchat is no Facebook. I don't think Snapchat is necessarily a canary in the coal mine, but probably a company that doesn't have as good of a model. And that's what we saw in retail as well. So if you're paying attention to the underlying numbers, the consumer has not retreated. The savings has slowed down, but they're still saving, and they still have, the revised GDP numbers, they saved over $1 trillion in the first quarter, and that's on top of $2 trillion in excess pre-pandemic. So I think the reality is somewhere in between, as it always is with the market, and I agree this is a bit of a relief rally. We really expect the market to right size in the fourth quarter.
Well, look at you. Just so if the underlying inflation rate is let's say 4 to 5%, according to the PCE report we had yesterday, all right, the Fed funds rate ought to be 5 or 6% if you're going to knock inflation out. Now they have not yet started. They're still increasing bonds, but they haven't started capping their portfolio yet and working it lower. They're not going to defend the bond market the way they have been for the past several years. The economy is growing around 2%. As I said, GDP now is 1.9%. That's the latest reading from the Atlanta Fed. I know that's subject to lots of changes, blah, 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 blah. It's just, Stephanie, it's just hard for me to understand why market rates have been coming down. The 10-year is back to 2.75%. I'm very suspicious and skeptical of that, and therefore I'm very suspicious and skeptical of this market rally.
I think that people did not do their homework on the first quarter GDP numbers because the GDP numbers were heavily influenced by very volatile things, inventories and exports, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at underneath the surface, consumption was actually quite strong and business investment was actually quite strong.
Right.
So I'm in your camp, Larry. People took that negative number and they extrapolated it and said, okay, then all of a sudden we now have a consumer that's kind of a little shaky based on some of the company earnings reports that we've received. And so they're saying, you know, consumer 70% of U.S. GDP. And so they're saying, okay, now we're on our way to another negative quarter in the second quarter. We're just going to see a lot slower growth in general. And
C plus I was 3.9%.
I know.
I'm just saying, the economy is right. If the falling Steph, all, I don't mean to interrupt, but if falling rates are predicting a recession, I would be very leery of that recession.
Yes.
I mean, there may be a recession out there next year after the Fed gets done tightening this year, but right now, I don't know. Color me skeptical.
Well, I think we are also seeing a transition within the consumer from goods to services. And in mm-hmm. fact, the second revision to GDP we got on Thursday, and it showed that goods consumption was flat, but services rose 4.8%. And why do we root for services? It's 70% of U.S. consumption. So we are rooting for services to do well, and that is all about the reopen. So I would agree with you. Underneath the surface, I think the economy is much stronger. I do not see a recession this year, possibly next year. We don't know what's going to happen mm-hmm. next year. But this year, I think there's too much still momentum in the economy. And you can't take a couple of reports from Walmart and Target and extrapolate that the consumer is dead. I just don't think you can do that.
All right, let's take a quick break, come back to all this. Nancy Tengler of Laffer Tengler Investments, Stephanie Link of Hightower Advisors. I'm Larry Kudlow. We will be right back with much more on stocks.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show on 77 WABC.
WABC.
Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back, folks. We're talking stocks with Stephanie Link, Chief Investment Strategist, Hightower Investors, Head of Investment Solutions, and Nancy Tengler, CEO and Chief Investment Officer, Laffer Tengler Investments. Nancy, I want to get your take on the strategy. Just want to add one little factoid. I just actually noticed this. Crude oil finished the week at $115. I didn't even realize that. $115. Yeah. Whatever happened to the Spro sale? Anyway, Nancy Tengler, what do you do here?
You be disciplined and focused. We put a lot of money to work week before last. Our clients have been sending us money, not taking money out. That's always it could be a contrary indicator, but we have very smart clients, obviously. And so I'm quite encouraged by it. They're sending the money for the right reason and sort of exhorting us to put it to work. So we've done a couple of things. In August of 2020, we said when the 10-year Treasury yield hit 50 basis points or 0.5%, we said that bonds were riskier than stocks. And so we began moving our clients into our alternative strategy. We added some to convertibles. And then last year, Arthur Laffer Jr. runs also a five-star rated inflation strategy, dynamic inflation strategy, and we've been moving clients into that as well. And staying away from bonds for the most part, though we've just now started to re-enter in the last couple of weeks and building ladders for our clients. But our equity strategy is an equity income strategy, so it's defensive by nature. You get growing dividend growth. So I've really been encouraging listeners on the shows I appear on to focus on dividend growth, because that's the ultimate hedge against inflation if your income is growing and you own stocks. And so those names are not hard to find. Dividend season or first quarter dividend announcements were extraordinarily robust in my experience. And, you know, many years ago, Tony Spear and I wrote a book called Relative Dividend Yield. And that's what we utilize as our metric to buy stocks. But that's a little in the weeds. What's really important is that management set dividend based on what they think long-term sustainable earnings power is. And so in that case, we've gotten some pretty good indication from management that they still see a robust business cycle. Target, Lowe's just announced a 30% dividend increase. And they, by the way, were able to expand their margins last quarter. So great management teams that know how to execute. And then dividend growers, and you'll be happy, I think, that you've invested here.
Yeah, no. I love the dividend play. I think it's exactly right. But, and the trickier the times, even more important to have a dividend play. So I think you're spot on. Stephanie, how are you on the dividend play, and how are you on bonds?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I've got to tell you, when I started getting a lot of phone calls when the 10-year got hit over 3%, and our advisors were just saying, well, why wouldn't I just put some money into bonds? I mean, we haven't been able to get anything out of bonds in years, and now it's at 3%. And it's interestingly, the bond market's rallied. I don't think you really want to, you don't want to be in that 60-40 mode for sure. You do want to look at other things within that 40 composition, and that is alternatives, and it is convertibles, and that is dividend growing companies. So I own a fair amount of companies that have dividends. I prefer dividend growth and high dividends, and I think companies, what's been really very exciting this year has been companies are flush with cash. Free cash flow is just pouring in. And you asked about energy. Well, I mean, they're making so much money that they're issuing special dividends. They're not only increasing the dividends and buying back their stock, but they're special dividends. And this is a group that is not known for that. You know, it's a boom and bust kind of group. But over the last several years, they've heard the words from shareholders that they want them to be more ESG friendly, clean energy, responsible investments, and to return cash to shareholders, and that's exactly what they're doing. It's interesting about energy. So about a year and a half ago, energy was only 2% of the S&P 500 in terms of a weighting. Today, it is just shy of 5%. Hmm. Back in the day, you'll remember this, Larry, and maybe Nancy too, it got as high as 19%.
Right. By the way, you mentioned ESG. How can they take Elon Musk off ESG? he's the original E. I mean, he's making electric cars, and they took him off? Really?
I know.
Huh? Well, I mean, I know. It has nothing to do with the fact that he's for free speech and voting Republican.
Well,
but
it's so arbitrary, right? I mean,
poor
guy. The designation.
They're throwing stewardesses at him, and they're taking him off the ESG list, and oh, my God. I can't. I'm sorry. I know that has nothing to do with anything, but it's just, you know, my mind works in very strange ways. Is anybody, either of you, you going to buy oil or you going to buy commodities? Two questions real quick. Nancy Tangler,
yeah.
Would you buy oil? Would you buy commodity indexes?
We run a strategy that invests in the metals and miners that will drive planetary decarbonization, and we hedge it with oil because we're realists. So, it is obviously at super high levels, but I think some of the commodities, because of the supply, I mean, the greenies are squeezing us on both sides, not just oil. They don't want to let you mine for the metals that will drive electric vehicles. So the supply-demand issue alone is compelling.
I mean, Steph, commodities have weakened quite a bit. I don't think the ag indexes have, but the rest of them have weakened a lot.
Well, I'll tell you what, if the Fed backs down, I'm not saying they are, but if they back down, commodities are going through the roof.
Yeah.
I am double my benchmark weighting in energy, and I also like copper very much. Can't get that. That's very hard to mine.
Ooh.
And Freeport, McMoRan, and that goes into electric cars, right? So, so that's really where I'm at in the commodity world.
I kind of like that. I mean, geez, you know, we had all this Fed breastfeeding. We're going to conquer inflation. We're going to do, I mean, literally, Jay Powell took his shirt off and you could see the hair growing on his chest. And now the entire market is saying, no, it's not going to happen. They're going to back off. There's really no inflation. It's really only 4%, not 10%. I don't get all this. I mean, I'm kind of baffled by all this myself. I think you ladies are right, though. Dividends look good to me. That's probably. Wait, come on, the 10-year bond's going to 3.5%. The 10-year bond should, that with an inflation rate, say the inflation rate is 4, okay? How can you have a 2.75% 10-year forever? How could you, even a 2% funds rate? If the inflation rate is 4, that's twice their target.
Well,
I'd like to ask you a question.
Until they shrink the balance sheet, right? They haven't even started that.
They haven't started yet. That is correct. Yeah. They have not started yet. You want a good contrary thing, Nancy Tendler? I think Stephanie's got it. Buy the commodities.
Yeah, no, contrary. And we are. And copper is four times as much copper goes into an electric vehicle than a combustible engine vehicle, not to mention the other applications in green energy. So I'm willing to make money on anything for our clients, and that's why we've directed them in that direction, but we've kept our hedge on oil. And, you know, to Steph's earlier point, EOG Resources is a perfect picture of an energy company that not only doubled their dividend in the last year, but they've paid three specials and announced a fourth. So $1, $2, $1, and the next one is $1.80. And that's one of our largest energy holdings. So I think your listeners should, you know, be paying attention to the dividend growers as a way to sort of hide and provide protection, but also to grow their income over time.
Stephanie Link, you own Twitter?
No. I did in the past, and it was really a trading kind of a stock, because they could never execute, which is exactly why Elon Musk is coming in and wanting to take them private. But I don't think the risk reward makes any bit of sense. I mean, he doesn't make any bit of sense, right? So it's not trading on fundamentals, and that's what I do, and you know that. That's what Nancy does. That's what I do. We look at fundamentals. We look at balance sheets and free cash flow and market share data and all that stuff. And this should be a much better run company, and maybe Elon can do it, but I don't think it's going to be at the initial price that he actually offered for it.
Nancy Tengler, do you own Tesla?
No, I have in the past. when he started smoking a bong and drinking whiskey on the Joe Rogan show and sleeping on the floor of the factory, we had taken a double, and I said, I think this is more like gambling. What I missed, Larry, was that Larry Ellison came onto his board.
Yes.
And we, in the old days, we used to buy and sell Oracle based on whether or not Larry was sailing around the world.
Terrific. Terrific. Ladies, this is the best. Stephanie Link and Nancy Tengler, best of the best. I'm Kudlow, folks. Stick around. We're going to do Money and Politics with Steve Moore and Liz Peek. And the question is whether Donald Trump is going to run for president or not. Please stick around.
WABC, New York.
WABC. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Join us during the week. Fox Business, the name of the show is Kudlow, 4 to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. And two of the stars on the show are right here. Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist, and Steve Moore, FreedomWorks Committee to Unleash Prosperity. And his latest book is called Govzilla. Welcome back, kids. I just found this article. I don't think Donald Trump likes Liz Cheney. This is in the Washington Examiner. Trump's going out to Wyoming to rally against Liz Cheney. In addition to Trump, we have Cheney's primary challengers, Harriet Hagerman. The rally is expected to feature former House Freedom Caucus Chairman Andy Biggs, Matt Gaetz, Lauren Boebert, and Kat Kamak. And in addition to that, on video, Kevin McCarthy, Elise Stefanik, and Jim Jordan. So they're all. So what do you make of this, Steve Moore? You think Liz Cheney can pull this one out? There's sending the troop, the whole cavalry is going to Wyoming to defeat her.
Well, did you say that McCarthy is going?
Yeah, Kevin McCarthy's doing a video. Videos. McCarthy, Stefanik, and Jim Jordan are doing videos, and in person is Trump. Andy Biggs, Lauren Boebert, Kat Kamak, and oh, by the way, the woman running against her, Harriet Hagerman.
Yeah. I was just curious whether Kevin McCarthy has come out against Liz Cheney, because normally the leader of the Republican House wouldn't come out against an incumbent. But I don't like all this internal fighting right now. I mean, the enemies are the people who are destroying our economy, like Joe Biden and the Democrats in Congress. And so I wish, frankly, that Trump would focus on that. And, you know, the more that I've said it so many times on your show, but the more Biden is in office, the better Trump looks. And, you know, let's go after the guys who really destroyed the economy. So far in the primaries, there have been 13 primaries. Larry, we have a little item in the hotline about this today. The Republican turnout is up almost 40%. And you know how much the Democratic turnout is up?
Zero.
2%.
Two. Yeah. No, it was close.
If that holds up, this is going to be this is going to make the 1994 and 2010 look like a picnic for the Democrats. So that's my attitude about it. I just don't like the internal fighting.
No, I think you have a good point. So Liz Peek, let me run down. I've had Kellyanne Conway on the TV and the radio. She's got a very good new book out, her memoirs. Here's the deal, her memoirs. But Liz, I want to read you Byron York's latest column. Byron's a very, very smart guy. A new Mark Penn poll. Penn is a Democratic pollster, but a darn good one. 41% of Republicans named Trump as their favorite for president. He's got a big lead over everybody else. 12% Florida Governor DeSantis, 7% Pence. But listen to this, Liz. When he asked on the Democratic side, only 23% of Democrats chose Biden. Wow. He's an incumbent president, and his own party is saying 23%. Now, I just think that's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. I am quite sure you could go back in time, and maybe Jimmy Carter had similarly poor support from his party, but I doubt it. I mean, people still liked Jimmy Carter, and I think what we're seeing is people don't even really like Joe Biden. And it's showing up in the primaries. He just recently lost one. An incumbent out in Oregon's 5th District has lost, apparently, to a progressive, which is not great news, but it is a very clear test because that's one that Joe Biden actually weighed in on. Another politician running in Ohio has said quite explicitly he does not want Joe Biden campaigning with him. I think I'd say on the Trump side, actually, I think the number used to be bigger. I mean, I do think over these last several months, and of course his enemies are really looking for data on this, but I do sort of sense that there's a seeping of support from Trump to Ron DeSantis or other possible Republicans, just because, not at all to do with his policies, but just because Trump cannot let go of his grievance about the 2020 election. And I think people recognize that that is a hard sell on the campaign trail. It's not forward-looking. It's not upbeat. So I think both Biden and Trump, frankly, Larry, for at least the last 8 or 9 months, I've said I don't think Trump's going to win. I don't think he'll be the candidate. I don't really know how that's going to evolve, but I just don't think he's going to do it because I think he recognizes that he's losing support and he can't let go of the last election. And I think it's a tragedy because I think right now, to Steve's point, I think the Reuters poll just showed more support for Trump than Biden. He beats Biden now. But it's not going to happen unless he kind of repackages his policies, which were so popular and so successful, and hits the campaign trail talking about the future and not the past.
Yeah, and to that point, can I just make one quick point? This was a bad week for Trump. I mean, what happened in Georgia was quite a repudiation, actually. I mean, and that wasn't even a close race, Larry. I mean, and the reason, by the way, was that Kemp is a good governor.
He's
been a good governor.
Yeah.
So people said, why are we going to get rid of this guy? And, I think that, look, I love Trump, and I would help him any way I could. But I think he makes everything so personal and about him rather than the country that it's a little off-putting.
Well, I want to add to this. In the Mark Penn poll, this kind of is to Liz's point. In a Biden-Trump matchup, it's almost even. Trump wins, but it's 45-42. So as bad as Biden is, it's pretty much an even split. Now, the reason what prompts this is that Kellyanne has been saying that Trump would like to run again, and he has unfinished business. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what do you think of that? Liz, it's sort of what you're saying. If he focused on the unfinished business, meaning the issues and the policies, extending the tax cuts, improving the border, and so forth and so on, that would be fine. If he goes back to the 2020 race, that would not be fine. So I kind of like the unfinished business part.
Yeah, but
I didn't know what you thought about that. He would like to run.
It's a great campaign, right? I mean, let's take the border and finish the wall, for example, which
right now, I think
a lot of people would raise their hands and say, yeah, we need to do that. And on education, there's so much yet to be done. Let's face it, on infrastructure, one of the things that's so disheartening about the infrastructure bipartisan effort that went forward and all the money that was put forward to that, all the reforms, the fast-tracking, and the effort to kind of get around the roadblocks, literally and figuratively, that have held up infrastructure spending, you know, were basically discarded by the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. What about the Abraham Accords? I mean, my gosh, it's a great campaign, but Larry, there's just no indication that he's ready to kind of, you know, ascend to that and mm-hmm. make that his platform. Instead, it's all about voting. And I just really, it grieves me because I think he was so successful and he needs, you know, he needs to revisit why he was successful.
Yeah, I mean, Steve, going to Wyoming and getting all these people to gang up on Liz Cheney is all about the 2020 election. It's all about the January 6th business. It's all about the impeachment business.
Yeah.
It's not about issues, Steve. It won't be about issues.
No, and that's his strong suit, his issues, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the American people. I mean, the polls are showing clearly that people liked Trump's policies. There were just too many Americans who were turned off by, you know, that like these actions. And I want to make one other quick point about these primaries that, I mean, look at the turnout. And even Democratic turnout is up a little bit. I thought the Democrats said that we're in an era of voter suppression.
Right.
You know? And
right.
It's unbelievable. So it shows you can have clean elections where, you know, legal people or people who are allowed to vote are voting and not keep people away from the polls. And there is so much interest in the elections now that, you know, look, I do think I disagree a little bit with Liz. I mean, I think it's going to be hard if Trump runs for any Republican to take that nomination away from him. Although if he stays on the course he's on and makes it about himself rather than the country, maybe that could happen. But I think Ron DeSantis, Larry, has said, if Trump's running, I'm not running.
Yeah.
So who would take it away from him?
There's nobody. Let me take a quick break right here. I want to go to Joe Biden in Japan, essentially accepting high gas prices. And this whole new word, the Democrats have a new word for the economy. It's transitional, which means no fossil fuels, which I think means a permanent recession. But we'll come to that. We've got Liz Peek from Fox News, syndicated columnist Steve Moore from FreedomWorks and Unleash Prosperity, and his book is Govzilla. I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Larry Kudlow on 77 WABC. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're here with Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist, and Steve Moore, FreedomWorks, Committee to Unleash Prosperity. His book is Govzilla. Kids, Joe Biden in Japan asked about gasoline prices. Didn't have anything to say bad about them. And he makes this incredible transition. We're making an incredible transition. And he says, God willing, when it's over, we'll be stronger and the world will be stronger. And my thought is, this is their whole now. I hear this from different spokespeople. We're economy in transition, which means you're going to try to get rid of fossil fuels. And my thought here is if we get rid of fossil fuels, you know, God willing, there may not be an economy. And I just think it's the most radical part of their radical agenda. And this is the most radical example of it. And Steve Moore, I'm going to start this with you, because in addition to that and this fossil fuel business, CBO once again comes out with their long-run growth forecast of 1.5%. We ought to be growing at 3.5 to 4%. But the fossil fuel, ending fossil fuels, I don't even know if we'll get 1.5%. How crazy are these people? Do they think the country wants this?
They're really crazy. I mean, people should pay attention to what these people at Davos were saying. I know they're all your good friends, Larry.
Yes.
But these people are spooky, actually. I mean, their speeches were all about cars. People can't have cars. Everybody's going to have to ride buses and trains, of course, except for us. We're going to have our private jets and we're going to have our cars. But everybody else, I mean, seriously, they're saying no more cars. They're saying no more airplane rides. We can't, you know, people are just going to have to get poor. They want basically to track people in terms of how much energy they're using. I mean, it's Orwellian stuff, and they're open about it. And so Biden was just sort of echoing the sentiment of these really radical, crazy authoritarians that were at Davos. And, you know, today in America, Larry, we get about 70 to 75% of our electric power and our, you know, our gasoline and our fuel from fossil fuels, about right. 70 to 75%. This is lunacy. I mean, I was speaking at a conference in Denver this week to a bunch of the people who own the car dealerships. And I just said, how many people are, first of all, they said, you can't get a car. One dealer told me he usually has 1,200 cars on the lot. You know how many he has right now? 40. Mm. 40. Mm. You can't buy a car these days. Try it. They're back order for sometimes 8 weeks, 3 months. But then I asked him about the electric vehicles. He said, yeah, people are coming in electric vehicles, but only about less than a third of the people are buying new cars want an electric vehicle. Mm-hmm. So this idea that everybody's going to go to electric vehicles, Americans have a love affair with their cars. And we like, you know, there's a lot of people like me who like the old-fashioned combustible engine.
Right. So vroom, 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 vroom. I like that. Vroom, vroom. Liz Peek, did you make the cut for Davos this year?
No, gosh, I'm so sorry. I would have loved to have gone there because some of the speeches just sounded completely nuts, as Steve was saying. But on this electric vehicle thing, DeRoy Murdoch has a good column out today talking about the lack of seriousness about this effort. For example, in terms of accessing the kind of lithium materials we need and rare earths and so forth, there is no indication of a plan in our country to satisfy the need for these kinds of essential ingredients in converting to electric vehicles. There is no investigation of it, as far as I know. So it's all just a pipe dream and just talking points for a president who has been given these talking points and who feels like he has enormous support on combating climate change, even though poll after poll shows it's like the seventh most important thing right. to most Americans. It's baffling, I think, to all of us, because this is something where this is really very public policy making, and it's really very unpopular. Yes, there is a coterie of younger people, mostly in white liberals, who are really keen on climate change, but really, most of America. I mean, I was just thinking when you're going vroom vroom, Indianapolis 500 with electric vehicles. That's going to be pretty exciting, right?
Let me add one thing to what Liz was saying. You know, there are forecasts that they're going to be rolling brownouts and blackouts in California, not just in California, but other states. Now, Liz, you're right. You know, all these young people think it's so wonderful to go to green energy. Let's see how much they like it when they try to charge their, their cell phones and nothing comes out. There's no juice. I mean, this isn't just an economic crisis. It's a public health crisis, a security crisis when the lights go out in a state with 40 million people. And now other states are looking at that because of over-reliance on completely unreliable sources of energy like solar and wind. By the way, why are they against natural gas and nuclear power, which are two of the cleanest forms of energy?
Well, there's a good piece actually today also about Michigan, and which will have rolling blackouts probably because they closed down, I think, their last nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
And to your point, that was the biggest portion of the state's not reliable and also carbon-free energy. So again, my contention is these are not serious people. They don't really look at a very complex energy industry and make intelligent decisions. It's all for headlines. And sadly, it is sort of common everyday people who are paying huge prices for gasoline, who are going to have to pay 12% more for electricity this summer. This is a horror show. And shame on these people who are making it happen.
Well, it's going to destroy the economy. It's a very important point, because there's no alternatives. There's no alternative plan. Look, the lead editorial in the Journal today, America's summer of rolling blackouts.
Yeah.
Green energy policies are making the nation's electric power grid increasingly unstable. Yep. It will destroy the economy. And that's GOP should just, Steve, blatantly, simply, clearly say that this transitional stuff will destroy the economy. We will be in a permanent recession. We won't even get 1.5% growth, which itself is pathetic, Steve. I mean, that should be front and center.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's be very clear about this. They're talking about going back to Middle Ages energy.
Right.
This is what they used to use in the Middle Ages as windmills. And so it is a dangerous thing. And I have to say this, that, you know, we have the United States. Trump talked about this a lot. I've heard you talk about it. We've cleaned up our environment more than any other country in the world.
Right.
We have the cleanest energy in the world. So this idea that we're some kind of major polluter, which is what the kids are learning, is crazy. And you know, the big thing that has cleaned up our air and reduced our greenhouse gas emissions is moving towards natural gas. And, you know, we have 300 years of natural gas. You tell me we're not going to use it? That's crazy. Yeah.
And we have the cleanest natural gas in the world, I might add. I had Steve Coonan on earlier in the show. He said the same thing. I mean, look, at you've got technology breakthroughs, Liz, including, you know, sequestration and storage. Carbon sequester and storage is a huge new technology. If the financing is there, that makes all these fossils that much cleaner.
Yes, but, you know, I think that, again, they would not want to hear that. There will not be any investigation of that or serious pursuit of that, because that would perpetuate the dominance of fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the Democrats are always talking about the big lie being the stolen election. I think the big lie is that all of this climate transition can happen with no cost.
Right.
I mean, most people... AOC has no idea where electricity comes from. You hear electric cars. Oh, great. Where does the electricity come from, folks? It isn't magic. It isn't like it comes out of a plug. It comes from mostly fossil fuels. So it's sort of an idiotic obsession. Again, I don't think it's serious. It's simply something that generates headlines and makes progressives feel good about themselves. But again, what's so infuriating, Larry, it's as always, it's the little people who get hurt by this.
Yes.
The
yes.
people have to drive to work every day.
Yes. Working
They're
folks.
Struggling.
Working folks. That's exactly right. And Steve Moore, S&P 500 index people just took Elon Musk off the ESG list.
I mean, really?
Yeah. They took him off the ESG list. Yeah. He was the darling of the ESG list, right? You think it has anything to do with free speech and he's going to vote Republican? They took him off the list. This is S&P 500 index, people. Liz, you know about this stuff.
Yep.
They just took him off the list.
Well, I think if the American people knew what was going on under the guise of ESG investing and how their major financial institutions are guiding money basically into favored industries in this way, and conversely keeping it. Why are good question with oil prices up? Why aren't there 3,000 rigs drilling and they're not? Well, because oil companies are convinced that they are under attack, and they are.
You know what's really interesting? You know what the three best performing stocks have been over the last 12 months? ConocoPhillips. Exxon and Chevron. So all they've done is make these greedy oil companies more money, because the price of oil has gone from basically, I think it was about $60 a barrel when Trump left office. Now it's, what, $105 a barrel?
Yeah,
so,
but they,
I mean, it's ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, but they kept Exxon. They kept Exxon on the ESG list.
It's unbelievable. Can't make this stuff up.
I mean, that's
By the way,
really.
Let me just add one quick thing before we go up. You're right. This is an assault against our economy. It's an assault about what you call the greatest path to prosperity. It's an assault against the free enterprise system. They all talk about collective action. What is collective action? It's government, 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 government.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely right. So these are the central planners. You really have to see this in terms, again, use Newt Gingrich. This is big government socialism versus free enterprise capitalism. That's the deal. State sponsored. Anyway, that's it. We got it. Liz Peek, thank you very much. Steve Moore, thank you very much. Folks, I'm Larry Kudlow. Pleasure to be with you. Remember, please, those who gave their lives for American freedom on Memorial Day. I'll be back next weekend.
WABC.
Hemorrhoids can be a real pain in the butt, causing anal itching and burning and irritation. Get fast relief with all-natural, doctor-developed and tested Anacool. Buy Anacool, A-N-A-C-O-O-L, on Amazon right now and save 15% with code WABC2024.